Okay, good. So this wasn't exactly the list of questions I was envisioning. So we didn't get to see these before. Oh, and it's going to cover them up so we can't see them anymore. So it wasn't important that we see them in advance because we can't see them now. But so in some sense, you know, one of the things that I've been discussing with people in this group over the past few days has concerned really something to do with your first question, which let me give you my version of that, and since it's one that I've discussed with Jim as well, he may want to either correct me or agree as he sees fit. But can one apply kinetic theory to, say, something like shoot flow, which is something that a number of people have challenged? So I think Jean Hachenbach and Michel Lelouch have raised questions about whether just how applicable that might be, and then there have been proponents on the other side. So I think Kumaran and Jim, I think, have argued back that there's reason to believe you can apply kinetic theory to shoot flow. So let me give you a cut of this, which is we're raised as physicists to think of phases of matter, molecular matter, as being clearly distinct. You have a solid, you have a liquid, you have a vapor, gas, whatever you like to call it, and that you would not dream of taking an equation of state which you think has been developed for one and applying it to the other. Now, what I sort of see coming out of this is that that may not be anything more than a cultural bias. That if you take something like a van der Waals equation, which was sort of borrowed from an ideal gas, you can actually do not such a bad job at getting gross properties of a liquid vapor phase transition. Okay, well, if you take kinetic theory for granular material, which was intended for conceptually a particular regime, but you enhance it, and so you do a Chapman Enskog extension of that, which is conceptually validated under certain conditions, certainly for molecular matter, you can extend the regime of applicability. And so if I now come from the other side of things and think of really dense flows, slow shear flows, such as Wolfgang Lozert and I do, for instance, in shear cells, okay, we have, of course, a rather different picture of force chains, but where the whole dynamics of the elasticity, say, that's released in plastic failure events, then couples into a kinetic energy field. And so I could imagine equally well, and I think that's sort of what Michel Lelouch is thinking about, and maybe Denise, that somehow you have correlated motions, which are really driven either by elastic release or some other kind of phenomena like that, that may apply in particularly dense regimes. And so while you wouldn't want to describe a true gas with any kind of picture like that, but there's a crossover regime, and there may be many phenomena, maybe even Doug Durian's impacts of objects into a granular bed, where the material lives in this never-never land, where to a certain extent either picture fails to a certain extent conceptually, but also is moderately successful, reasonably successful in a number of points, in actually capturing the relevant phenomena. So your question is, well, okay, are we misborrowing concepts, say, from kinetic theory and saying, well, we can get 10% accuracy or 20% accuracy? That's probably true, but I'm not so sure it's such a terrible thing. That really recognizing that you might have multiple descriptions in this gray area that are equally successful at describing the phenomena conceptually might be a good thing to admit, and then see what you can make out of that. So that's my piece for the moment, at least.
I'll just turn up the contrast. What we have in a lot of random mechanics situations is a kind of not a many body problem, but a few body. You know, a lot of bodies, but not many bodies. And we don't have the kind of separation of length between the microscopic description and the macroscopic phenomenon we want to examine that are characteristic of all of these regions. And our strategy seems to be to ignore that inconvenient fact rather than trying to be clever and find a way.
I don't know if I can address that particular issue, but maybe I'll just provide my perspective on what Bob's just said, because I certainly agree with it. I think that we're now becoming sensitive to the need to distinguish between various regimes of flows and to formulate theories based upon the mechanics that's appropriate to each. That is, I don't think that anyone believes that there is going to be a single universal theory that's going to allow us to get from slow rate independent flows to the collisional regime that resembles more a viscous fluid. And I think that, let's say, our extensions of the kinetic theory are recognizing that. In the first place, I think we have to repair our vocabulary a little bit. I think we have to be more subtle with our language. The notion of kinetic theory is rather rich. When we're talking about kinetic theories failing, we tend to be talking about the approximations or the assumptions upon which the simplest kinetic theory is based becoming invalid. And there are certainly ways to extend the formal apparatus of kinetic theory to deal with more complicated correlations, both between velocities and positions in space. And I think that that's what's beginning to be done by those who are hoping to extend the simplest kinetic theory into regimes where a richer structure, either in the velocity representations or in the spatial particle representations, is required. So I think there's some hope, although at the same time, the theory that might emerge or the techniques that have to be employed might not resemble anything that's in the present classical arsenal used by kinetic theorists. It's not clear. That's one extreme, let's say. So that's one extreme of the dense regime that I think we're making some progress on. That is, I have a lot of faith in the applicability of the kinetic theory in situations where we do have binary collisions and we don't have large velocity correlations. Our experience at Cornell is that it's a very excellent predictive theory. And the reason I say that is it gives us a place to stand. You know, at least we have a little region of parameter space where we know something. And we can begin to attack our ignorance from that position of knowledge. And with respect to the dense flows, it seems to me that the attack is taking place in the appropriate way. That is, I see people doing numerical simulations, doing them now with the motivation of testing theories. And it seems to me that if we have that kind of an experimental program that's taking place, we can hope to make very rapid progress in understanding the type of theories that are most successful in explaining that regime that's, let's say, closest to the kinetic theory. On the other hand, the regimes that Bob is talking about and that Gary Gress talked about, and Wolfgang, that is, these slow rate-independent continuous deformations are kind of at the other pole of the dense regime. And I would agree with Bob to the extent is I don't think we should confuse those two flows, because the micromechanics that is appropriate to each flow and perhaps the statistical mechanics that's necessary to describe them are much different. So it seems to me that to the extent we have faith in, let's say, elasticity or some crude plasticity in that regime, we should stand in that well-understood region of parameter space and try to attack the extended deformation in a rate-independent way from that perspective. I think that's the hardest problem that's remaining to us right now. As I believe, I have faith that the dense, more or less collisional flows are going to yield rather quickly. I'm more pessimistic about the rate independent, because I guess what I'm saying is, I think we need more sensitivity to the specific regimes we're working in. We don't want to confuse the microscopic mechanisms that are fundamentally involved in the various regimes, and we have to encourage our colleagues who are doing numerical simulations to at least take some time out to challenge theories and prove them wrong, or perhaps provide some support for their applicability. Now, with respect to this, the idea of a length scale diverging, from my perspective, that may be an element of confusing these two regimes that I'm talking about. That is, the idea of a length scale going to infinity may bring us from a regime that's near collisional to a regime that's rate independent. And I think that we have to be discussing things other than length scales in order to understand the transition between those two regimes. Let's see. And finally, let's say the geophysical applicability of theories. I mean, I think we saw two great examples of how relatively little physics implemented in the appropriate granular material context can go a long way. I think that Herbert and Andy are getting a lot of mileage out of relatively simple theories that seem to be perfectly appropriate. The question is where the geophysical phenomena really depend upon the constitutive relations that are necessary to describe them, and then we're confronted with the same level of ignorance that we have in describing even the simplest and most ideal flows. And finally, you know, with respect to the let's say Edwards formalism, I mean, it seems to me that I've seen a lot of progress. I mean, I was among those that when these ideas were first formulated was simply bewildered that anyone could imagine that they'd have any relevance in granular materials. And I've been kind of surprised to see how, in fact, these ideas are becoming very fleshed out, and systems are being discovered in which they clearly do or may have some relevance. But still, it's not clear to me, you know, where their promise is going to be fulfilled for the field in general. And I'll leave you with that.
I'm supposed to talk as a last man here. So I would like to say something about what Tom, in the way Tom was speaking, it was sort of implied that it may have, there is a, you know, a paradise where thermodynamics and statistical mechanics hold, and this is for gases or liquids, and then granular matter is definitely doesn't belong to that paradise, and somehow importing concepts from glasses is some sort of illegal borrowing of the apple of thermodynamics into this terrestrial world. But in fact, one has to see that glasses themselves are not in that class. Glasses themselves live in the, at least glasses as they exist, live in this nasty world where thermodynamics actually does not hold. The fact that thermometers were made of glass, it was a bit misleading, but one doesn't even have a right to say that a piece of glass has a given temperature. Glasses are, as you know, out of equilibrium, and they are as out of equilibrium as any, say, heap of granular matter. So already, take for example the case of spin glasses, which is the perhaps, I don't know if better known, but the one where people have worked more, theoreticians have worked more extensively. Yes, if you are going to discuss the ground state of a glass, of a spin glass, apart from the fact that you will never observe that, you may perhaps discuss things about correlation length and so on. But in actual practice, the spin glass you're doing an experiment with is out of equilibrium, and is as out of equilibrium as any granular matter thing. And furthermore, the subject of glasses doesn't have a clear frontier with the subject of plasticity. And in fact, if you apply a strong magnetic field to a spin glass, what you're doing is an experiment in plasticity. You're taking a system that has many valleys and a lot of difficulty to go from one place to another, and in a very non-linear manner, you're forcing it with great difficulty to go to another place in phase space. And if you're going to study such an experiment, there's not much in, say, in ordinary thermodynamics or statistical mechanics that will help you. So the developments that we are trying to import from glasses belong already to a world that is very imperfect, and in fact are already at a level of description that does not intend to apply neither thermodynamics nor statistical mechanics literally. Edwards's idea is a way to reintroduce some variant of thermodynamics, which is of course not the usual thermodynamics. And it's true that one part of the fact that we have some faith in it now is because of things we learned from glass theory, I think it's fair to say, and from simple models of people who actually were working with glasses. But in general, what my point, the point I would like to make, is that the line of fracture is not so much between thermodynamics, including glasses on one side, and dense granular matter on the other. It's between liquids, and especially liquids that are not sheared very strong or not stirred very strongly, and gases and crystals on one side. And on the other side, you have glasses, you have real crystals which are full of defects, and granular matter would pertain to such an ugly world, and as ugly, and with which we will have to deal.
So. Okay, why don't we ask for questions from the floor? Okay, Pierre.
I believe that it can also be useful for other things than geophysics, but granular material. What I mean, you have plenty of application in industry and so on. So I find that the useful for geophysics is perhaps good, but it can be also useful for many other things.
Well, I mean, we actually did have one talk on other applications, which was from Christine, but most of the applications-oriented talks were focused on geophysics this week. Kumara.
I was interested in your opinions on this being some sort of a paradigm for a driven dissipative system. Could we classify it as systems where energy is supplied by shear or by some other mechanism and dissipated, and, you know, look at the broader hydrodynamics, and are there similarities between this and other systems which are driven and dissipative in similar ways? And that would be one way of giving something back to physics. So.
I mean, it seems to me that we're at the edge, let's say. Everything we do from this point on, it seems to me, is going to be giving something back to physics. We've done most of the utilization of known techniques, and now, in order for us to make progress, we're going to have to do something new. Now, it's going to clearly be a contribution that's in the context of driven dissipative systems, but I say the next year is going to be a year that I think is, we'll be giving back to physics. One way or the other, we'll be dealing with...
Now.
Well, I mean, I kind of see all the classical techniques have been kind of explored, and not necessarily exhausted, but the appropriate let's say contributions have been made from the systems that we know about. And I say that in the various problems that we're dealing with, we're confronted with having to develop some new physics. And I'm optimistic. I mean, it seems to me that we're poised to do that, and at least one or two areas. And I think that, you know, we have great tools. I'm a big fan of numerical simulations. That's, we have numerical simulations that are realistic for the problems that we're dealing with. And we're a field of physics that has that as an advantage. Well, I think the dense granular flows, I think we'll have descriptions for dense granular flows within a year. And I think that these notions of the glassy state, I mean, I just see a lot of people kind of working in that area, and there's some elements of convergence that are taking place. I don't see how these ideas are going to be imported in an easy way to frictional systems. It seems that that's the biggest stumbling block, in my view. Yeah.
So let me give a slightly different, I think a related spin, but slightly different. If you say, well, will this apply to things like turbulence, okay? I mean, which has sort of been one of the classical examples of dissipated, relatively strongly nonlinear systems. I don't think so, right? I just don't see a great, that may be wrong, but I think, I would say, for instance, that the young folks sitting over here doing plasticity theory for low-temperature amorphous solids are sort of going to be the direction where insight from dense granular materials will be traded. I'm personally looking forward to that kind of evolution, and I think that the time scale is indeed one that's upon us right now, that we will, within a relatively short time, we'll at least know whether some of the pictures that have been used to describe amorphous plasticity in solids could be applied to dense granular materials. And one of the charms, so if you want to give something back from granular materials, even though it's the devil sometimes to really look into a granular material and get a lot of detail, it's a lot easier to look into a granular material than it is into a molecular system. And so there is the opportunity that you will really be able to go and look in a system. In 2D, it is actually possible to look at every detail you might want, and you can then explore analogs, and that may be a way of giving back. You know, I guess I've never quite thought of physics as being quite so altruistic, but I mean, building connections, I think, to other fields, and then having some reinforced, enhanced knowledge from that. I think that's a distinct possibility, and as Jim says, some of the hardest things will be in the dense granular materials, and I think also in developing connections to glasses where I see some very interesting questions arising there, even as to what one should think of as the relevant variables within. So let me rephrase the question of, is there such a thing as a granular temperature? Well, okay, is there a way, in fact, of characterizing fluctuations in a granular material as described by some set of well-defined control parameters? I don't think people have always thought in terms of what parameters one should be using to describe a dense granular material. And if you want to think of something really given to society at the end of this kind of development, if I go to real engineers, okay, real engineers doing simple problems like filling or emptying a silo, many of them recognize that the classical models that have been used for many years are, to a certain extent, bankrupt. That they're not terribly predictive, and that engineers have to put in gigantic fudge factors, partly because they don't know the range of behavior they might encounter. So by addressing questions of what fluctuations should one expect for dense granular flows, you are taking a step towards what is a really a great practical need. So I think there's both a theoretical development, which I think will benefit physics, but I think the potential for real practical understanding that will, if whoever used the word trickle down, okay, will trickle down to real applications that are really important in society.
Okay, Leo, you had your hand up.
I just want to address basically what's in the blue box and something that Jorge said. The issue of glasses is true. We still don't understand how to deal with glasses themselves, but I think one of the common themes emerging from the study of granular materials is that we might be able to look at granular materials as an analog of glasses in some sense. And perhaps instead of being as parasitic as Thomas has said, we might be able to look at granular materials and then feed back into the glassy community I mean, that's one of my own interests and thoughts, that it will be possible. And from experimental point of view, you know, we can look at granular materials with our own eyes, and in a sense, experimentally, they're easier to deal with. I mean, I think there's a bright future for that in the end.
Other questions?
I think I can add two examples of how granular mechanics can give something back to physics. And the first is indeed what Jim said, and driven dissipative systems. I mean, there are other paradigms, Bob, except turbulence. So there are different kinds of pattern formation, and as a pattern forming system, granular systems give plenty of examples, and some of them are very similar to what we see in fluids, like Faraday waves and oscillons and things like that. Some of them are widely different, and I think this comparison and sort of studies of universalities and breakdown of universalities can enrich a lot other fields. And the second thing is that granular systems are intrinsically sort of mesoscopic systems, if we use the terminology of solid-state physics. The scale separation at best is very moderate. I mean, very often, more often than not, it doesn't exist, which makes our life difficult. But if it does exist, it is very modest. And we can easily go to next orders and check simulations and experiments within next order approaches, which is often very useful to do. I'm sorry, very, very difficult to do in a classical physics, like in gas dynamics, like atmospheric air. It's very difficult to go to the Burnett corrections. You have really to work very hard to see them. Well, in our systems, more often than not, they're dominating and make our life difficult. So this comparison also can be very fruitful.
I can perhaps give an example of a very simple problem, which is one ball in a container, which you shake it, and you get it some kind of periodic motion. And in this case, it's related to the Fermi problem, but the Fermi problem gives you chaotic motion because the restitution coefficient is equal to 1. Here, the restitution coefficient is not equal to 1, and then you get this periodic motion, except that sometimes you get chaos. And the way the system will go to chaos is probably something which is important to understand. And I think that this kind of problem can also get some relation to the problem of quantum mechanics, of chaos in quantum mechanics, and so on. So I'm not sure that we can define already what will be the output of the physics of granular matter, but there are some analogy you can get, which go completely in different direction than what we think at the beginning.
Other comments or questions? Well, we are not prevented from ending early, so maybe I'll pass the mic back to the panelists and allow them to have one final word in reverse order from...
Well, just one comment about the... One thing we learned about glasses is that even admitting that we were not in equilibrium, even admitting that we were not going to be able, or that an equilibrium theory was going to be relevant, what amazingly happens is that some universality comes out and a few simple things you can still say. And this was a bit of a surprise. There was a tendency in people in the glass community to work on the liquid side and approach the glassy phase, but the moment it was getting glassy, just give up because nothing could be said. In fact, this doesn't seem to be the case. A few simple things can be said, even aging, which seemed to be the most... the least beautiful aspect, the fact that something kept changing with time and depended on history, even there are a few universal things that one can say. So I think that if that's something that is happening, and I think that it might happen, and it does happen to a certain extent, and we know that it does, in dense granular matter. So even giving up the simple-minded equilibrium thermodynamics and getting into the world of out of equilibrium, there are still things that can be said and are still relatively simple and relatively and quite universal and don't depend much on how the constituents are made. So that's a point that can give hope also.
Maybe I'll say something that's a little bit off the subject. But my perception is that much of the progress that's been made in the past couple years has been due to meetings like this that provide us with an extended opportunity for conversation. And there was a meeting in Cambridge that lasted for several months, and there was a recent meeting in Paris, and now this. And I think we ought to try to find ways to continue to bring the field together in such a fashion. So I'd like to encourage our Japanese colleagues and our Italian colleagues to consider the possibility of extending this run of international programs and perhaps continue the fertilization that these extended conversations bring to the field.
We could also, I guess, encourage our Dutch colleagues. They seem to arrive. Okay, good. So maybe now is a good time to rather than sort of introduce some new random thought. Maybe now is a good time actually for all of us to thank the organizers, Tom and Kumaran and Robin, if he's looking. Right.
Okay, I would like to make a final word about my own question, and then I'll let you go. I sort of grew up scientifically in the aftermath of the great critical phenomenon, the revolution of the 1970s. I was in graduate school in the early 1980s, and what you saw then was that the key experimental technique for studying the microstructures corresponding to critical phenomena. I mean, the thermodynamics could be studied by calorimetry or other means, but the key microscopic technique was scattering. And that was extremely effective in unlocking the various puzzles around the, basically phase transitions into and amongst ordered states. We then, as a statistical mechanics community, turned to disordered problems. And we ran into immediately the problem that the action in disordered problems doesn't really seem to be in K-space. There may be hints of it in K-space, but that's not where the fundamental microscopic phenomena are best understood. And so this led, in my view, to somewhat of a pause in the development of statistical mechanics. A number of people in the last 45 minutes have touched on this. I think in granular physics we have an opportunity to make some progress on that problem, precisely because of the fact that there's no good separation of length scales. So that means that numericists can do numerical studies on systems that are really quite realistic and tell you everything about the micromechanics of those systems and how they relate to the macroscopic behavior. Experimentalists can, led, I think, really by Bob Berenger, who's been a pioneer in this field of making such measurements in two dimensions, and we're starting to see, as in the microtomography results and the confocal microscopy reported by Wolfgang, an extension to three dimensions of similar techniques. So if you think about this whole range of dynamical problems involving amorphous materials and to some extent static problems, as in thermodynamics glasses involving amorphous materials, I think that there is a real hope that as we deepen our understanding of granular materials with the aid of these tools, we'll be able to make some progress that isn't possible in those more molecularly based materials, and hope for that in 5 or 10 years when we come back to the KITP, or Capri would be just fine too, Marty. I like gratitude to be expressed in concrete ways. We'll begin to see some of the things on the right-hand side here, on the left-hand side, as things whose puzzles are being solved by what we've discovered from the granular materials. Thank you very much, and I wish everybody a safe journey home.